WORT's local news for Wednesday, April 16th, 2025.
I'm your host, Vicki Iden.
And I'm your host, Robert McClure. In tonight's news, a federal bill that would require voters to provide proof of citizenship advances.
A victim services provider here in Madison grapples with funding uncertainty.
And in the second half, we'll take a closer look at the Daily Cardinal's recent special issue on immigration, revisit some headlines from 58 years ago, and of course give you all the possible details on this upcoming weekend's weather.
All these and more on tonight's news, but first we go live to the BBC for some news from around the world.
Hello, I'm Govinda Gill with the BBC News. A month-long confrontation between the US judiciary and the government over the deportation of alleged gang members has deepened. A judge has warned of possible contempt of court charges against officials. Judge James Boasberg said the administration had shown deliberate and gleeful defiance of a court order barring removal flights. From Washington, John Studworth reports.
A finding that the US government has knowingly and willfully breached a court order is rare, but the judge says that the evidence and the failure of government officials to offer a satisfactory response leaves him no choice but to reach that conclusion. Initially, Justice Department officials said that, as the order was verbal, it was unenforceable, and then later claimed that, as the flights had by that time already left US airspace, the order no longer applied. The government now has a week to rectify its actions, or hearings will be held to identify the responsible officials.
The White House says the legal American residents deported to El Salvador by the Trump administration last month will never live in the United States again. Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt said there is evidence that Kilmer Abrego Garcia is a member of the criminal gang MS-13.
Let me reiterate. Kilmer Abrego Garcia is an illegal alien, MS-13 gang member, and foreign terrorist who was deported back to his home country. Abrego Garcia was arrested with two other well-known members of the vicious MS-13 gang. And two separate judges found that Abrego Garcia was a member of MS-13, and that finding has never been disputed.
The head of the U.S. Central Bank says Donald Trump's tariffs are likely to put at risk its goals of controlling both inflation and unemployment. The Federal Reserve chairman said the levies were higher than expected and would probably lead to higher prices and lower growth. California has filed a lawsuit seeking to block President Trump's sweeping tariffs. Its governor, Gavin Newsom, warned they would seriously hurt the state's economy.
The manufacturing footprint in this state is disproportionately impacted by the tariffs, disproportionate to any other state in the nation. Of course, we talk about the fifth largest economy in the world. Let's put that in perspective. We're 14% of the U.S. GDP. That is 50% higher than the next state. No other state will be more impacted by the impacts of this uncertainty because of these tariffs.
Satellite imagery of what was Sudan's largest refugee camp reveals that Zamzam has been mostly destroyed by the paramilitary RSF. Makeshift houses have been torched following its capture on Sunday, and places are still burning. Sudanese women's rights activists say RSF fighters committed rape during the attack. BBC News. Israel's military says it seized 30% of land in Gaza for its buffer zone and insists Israeli troops will remain there even after any agreement to end the war. Since resuming their offensive last month, Israeli forces have carved out what they call a security zone to prevent attacks from Hamas. Qatar is to renew a $60 million grant to fund the salaries of Lebanon's army and provide dozens of military vehicles. The announcement comes during the first official visit to Doha by Lebanon's president, Joseph Aoun. The Qatari government said the grant is to help Lebanese forces maintain stability and control the country's borders. Scientists have found more evidence that a faraway world may possibly be home to life. The researchers at Cambridge University have detected signs of gas molecules in the atmosphere of the planet called K2-18b, which orbits a different star to the Sun. Here's our science correspondent, Pallab Ghosh.
18 months ago, scientists detected tiny hints of gas molecules in the atmosphere of planet K2-18b that might have been produced by life. Now, those leading the search have announced that the evidence has grown. They've detected what might be large quantities of a gas, which on Earth is produced by simple microorganisms. But these results are tentative and need to be treated with caution. The researchers don't have enough evidence yet to say for sure that the gas is really there. The Cambridge team say they hope to have enough data within 2 years.
The wine industry's main trade body says worldwide consumption has fallen to its lowest level since 1961. The international body of vine and wine says last year's sales figures were down by more than 3% compared with 2023. That's the latest BBC News.
Good evening, this is Rob McClure and Vicki Iden bringing you your local news live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in downtown Madison. Here are the headlines for this evening.
A federal judge has blocked the Trump administration from deporting an international student at UW-Madison, reports the Daily Cardinal. District Judge William Conley issued a temporary restraining order against the Department of Homeland Security yesterday. That prevents them from taking any action against the undergrad, including deportation, until a hearing is held in 2 weeks. Krishlal Isserdasani was informed his visa would be terminated earlier this month. He is from India, and among nearly 30 current and former UW-Madison students and at least 40 across the UW system whose visas were terminated in the last month. More than 600 international students and recent graduates across the country have had their visas revoked or their legal status challenged, reports the Daily Cardinal. Some have been deported by Immigration Customs Enforcement or ICE. Prior to the judge's ruling yesterday, Isserdasani had filed a lawsuit against DHS Secretary Kristi Noem and ICE Secretary Todd Lyons for violating his right to due process. Isserdasani was arrested for disorderly conduct last fall, but the DA declined to pursue the case. Judge Conley has scheduled a preliminary injunction hearing for April 28th, asking both parties to file additional briefs today.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is fast-tracking the permitting process for an Enbridge Line 5 tunnel, reports Wisconsin Public Radio. The proposed tunnel from Canadian giant Enbridge would replace a four-mile section of the pipeline in the Straits of Mackinac. It's estimated to cost $750 million. The Army Corps announced yesterday that the project is subject to emergency permitting following a move from President Donald Trump to declare a national energy emergency. The project has been under review for 5 years. Native nations have pushed back against the project, and they slammed the Army Corps of Engineers' decision yesterday. The Line 5 pipeline also faces legal challenges from Wisconsin environmental groups and the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. There will be a virtual public hearing in May on whether the Line 5 project violates water quality standards.
Both researchers and lawmakers are hoping to make Wisconsin into the, quote, Silicon Valley, unquote, of nuclear energy, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. A group of researchers from Rialta Fusion, a nuclear startup in Madison, and from UW-Madison have teamed up to build a small working fusion reactor. The reactor has been generating plasma successfully for the last several months. Meanwhile, both Wisconsin Democrats and Republicans seem to have the promise of clean nuclear energy on their minds as well. Governor Tony Evers included a nuclear feasibility study in his recent budget, and state Republicans have proposed several pieces of nuclear energy legislation. The legislation includes two bills and one resolution. The resolution asserts the state is a desirable location for nuclear energy development, which can help strengthen national security and provide clean, safe energy. That resolution has been approved and will be reviewed in a Committee on Rules meeting. A bill would create a nuclear power summit board, directing the state to hold a summit and providing funding for it. The last bill would order the Public Service Commission to complete a study on the best location for a potential nuclear plant in the Madison area. The bills have not been brought to committees yet, but might start receiving hearings as early as next week.
Legislation to complicate the process of Medicaid qualification has stalled out in the state assembly, reports Wisconsin Examiner. The bill would require double eligibility reviews. It would also force the state to fill in electronic forms manually and would impose a six-month enrollment ban upon anyone who fails to report a change that might affect their eligibility. The bill faced opposition in a public hearing last week, including from some of the Medicaid recipients who rely upon the program, who testified that the current requirements are already onerous. Roughly 18% of Wisconsinites are enrolled in Medicaid as of data from last summer. The program provides health and long-term care coverage, including to people with disabilities.
Over a dozen dead birds were found on a beach in Oak Creek today, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. This follows a number of similar reports from the Milwaukee area. The cause is likely the avian flu. Last month, the U.S. Department of Agriculture marked the outbreak as the largest and deadliest in history, with waterfowl, raptors, and domestic poultry among the most affected.
The city of Madison is set to begin construction on a new library branch this spring. When built, the Imagination Center, as it's called, on the city's north side is expected to serve more than 19,000 people. It's the first library, it's the city's first library in a park. Located off East Washington Avenue in Rheindahl Park, it's expected to include both indoor and outdoor spaces. It's funded with the help of an extra boost from the federal government received last fall. Construction is expected to finish up in fall of next year. It's been 25 years since Madison added a library branch. The last was built on the far west side, the Alicia Ashman Library, which became the ninth city library in 2000. Pinney Library, though, has since relocated to a new building. The Madison Public Library System is celebrating its 150th anniversary this year. The city's first branch opened in May of 1875.
Madison's new city council, featuring familiar faces and some new additions, held its inaugural meeting last night. And unlike a lot of council meetings, this one was a snappy 27 minutes. The council elected Westside Alder Regina Vitavere as council president. Campus area Alder MGR Govindarajan was elected council vice president. Both ran uncontested for the seats. This is the first time in recent memory that council leadership was decided on an uncontested ballot, reports the Wisconsin State Journal.
And those were this evening's headlines. On to the rest of the day's top stories now. The U.S. House of Representatives passed a bill last week that would require proof of citizenship when registering to vote. They say it would establish safeguards to prevent non-citizens voting, but advocates say the bill is a solution without a problem, one that risks disenfranchising, in fact, millions of eligible voters. Our producer, Faye Parks, has more.
Last fall, Wisconsin voters approved a constitutional amendment to prohibit people without citizenship from voting in local elections. More than 70% of Wisconsin voters said yes. And earlier this month, voters in Wisconsin also approved adding a voter ID requirement to the state constitution, this time by roughly 63%. Federal elected officials are also seeking to add more hoops to voting. Last fall, Wisconsin Congressman Tom Tiffany joined his fellow Republicans at the state capitol. He was there to champion the U.S. SAVE Act, which he argued prevents election fraud.
And when you look at 10 million people having come into this country illegally in just the last 4 years, this is something that's really ripe to be abused. And especially if you get people that are very zealous about they want their candidate to win at any cost, I just say to illegal aliens that are here in Wisconsin and across America, don't do this.
The federal bill amends the National Voter Registration Act of 1993. It requires individuals to prove their citizenship when registering to vote. And it requires states to purge people without citizenship from voter rolls. The SAVE Act stalled out in the Senate last year, but it's on the horizon again. The bill passed in the U.S. House last week with all Republicans and four Democrats voting yes. It now heads again to the U.S. Senate. If passed, voters who are registering for the first time or re-registering under a new address would have to provide proof of their citizenship. You'd need to give a birth certificate, passport, naturalization certificate, or another form of ID that lists your place of birth. Deborah Cronmiller is the executive director of League of Women Voters of Wisconsin. She points out that voting in federal elections as a non-citizen is already a felony and says that's enough of a deterrent.
This is clearly a solution without a problem. There is very, very little documented fraud in our elections throughout the United States. There's the least amount of voting among non-citizens of all the types of fraud.
Since 2019, only three people without citizenship have been prosecuted for voting in Wisconsin, according to data from the State Elections Commission.
And yet, this act, if brought to fruition, would have the very chilling effect of suppressing eligible voters from being able to register and cast their vote.
T.R. Edwards is staff counsel at Law Forward, a liberal firm based here in Madison. He says that the SAVE Act would walk back decades of progress.
For many years, this was a country that was run ostensibly by, frankly, wealthy, rich, white landowners that were cisgender. But over the last 60 years, we've seen a rapid expansion in that. We've seen young people, women, people of color enjoy the right of the franchise. And I want to clarify that it is a right, not a privilege. This type of act impinges on that, and I fear risks, diminishing that right into a privilege. So those folks that I think that are probably most at jeopardy are those same people that I mentioned, have recently just gotten access. By all accounts, at least 20 million Americans don't have ready access to the documents that are being requested. There's a number of people that will be affected if this law goes into effect.
The extra hoops would mean citizens are also disenfranchised. Cronmiller says a little less than half of Wisconsinites have a passport.
So if these individuals don't have ready access to their original birth certificate or a certified copy, they will have to get that, or they will have to get a passport. In order to procure those documents, especially if you were born outside of the state of Wisconsin, this amounts to a poll tax that you would have to pay for documents in order to maintain your right to vote, a right that's guaranteed to you.
And Cronmiller adds that another element of the SAVE Act is flying under the radar. Voters would have to present proof of citizenship in person, eliminating online and community-based registration.
Think about a person with a disability who might not easily be able to make their way to the clerk's office. Think about a person living in rural Wisconsin, where the clerk doesn't actually have an office. The clerk works out of their home because they're in a small jurisdiction. Where does the voter go to produce their passport, birth certificate, or naturalization papers?
But here's the concern that's gotten the most press. The SAVE Act could disenfranchise millions of Americans, many of them married women, whose names on their driver's licenses don't match their birth certificates.
They may have to jump through additional hoops to reconcile that problem. They may have to get a passport, which has costs and time, by the way. So you can't, the week before the election, you can't think, I need a passport, and you would be assured to have it by election day. That takes sometimes weeks and months to procure a passport. And that's given if you have all the documentation you need to, procure a passport.
Transgender people who change their names or the gender listed on their documents, Cronmiller adds, would also face those hurdles. The SAVE Act doesn't provide any guidance on how to handle those discrepancies. Instead, it directs each state to establish its own process. Edwards argues that this is a serious oversight.
When you leave it up to the states, you risk individuals falling between the cracks. If you run into a state that is not necessarily pro-democracy, if you run into a state that is not the best laboratory for what democracy could look like, I fear that those types of issues may not be resolved, or if they are resolved, aren't done without litigation. So you risk disenfranchising people simply because there was a political will to disenfranchise voters at large.
The SAVE Act is currently in committee in the Senate. If it becomes law, Edwards says, a legal challenge is highly likely.
Anytime you do things like this, not only do you risk disenfranchising voters, but you also risk complicating the system. Our clerks, we have over 1,800 in the state of Wisconsin, have a substantive enough job already. When you add in factors like this, you just make their jobs harder and make our elections worse.
For WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
Last night, Sun Prairie's council held their first meeting with the newly elected leaders. They spent nearly half of their time discussing a proposed budget increase for the police department to deploy new technology. WORT reporter Dane Bulow has more.
The technology goes by the abbreviation ALPR, that's short for Automatic License Plate Reader. Despite the fancy name, they're essentially cameras used by law enforcement agencies to track vehicles across jurisdictions. They're developed by one company, Atlanta-based Flock Safety. They work by cataloging license plates, vehicle types, and other identifying information. That information then gets run through crime databases. A 2023 investigation by WORT found that the cameras are growing in popularity, with more than 5 dozen law enforcement agencies using ALPRs throughout the state. They're used by at least 8 police departments within Dade County, including the Sun Prairie PD, which currently has 3 pairs of ALPRs.
So Sun Prairie has utilized the automatic license plate readers in different versions for the last decade. There are some that are mounted inside of patrol cars, and the Flock cameras specifically are mounted on poles in various parts of the city, primarily on the main avenues in and out of the city.
That's Sun Prairie Interim Police Chief Jeff Hook, presenting the technology to the Sun Prairie Council at a meeting last night. His proposal came in the form of a budget amendment to add 3 more cameras to the city. He says that the cameras are cheaper than staff and have helped solve several recent cases.
Remember that we had a homicide in the beginning of the year, and those cameras led the police department to the suspect within the first couple hours of that investigation. And subsequently, that person is in jail for that homicide. And the success of those cameras has ranged from homicide down to burglaries where there was a multi-jurisdiction burglary that was solved because of those cameras.
But some privacy advocates have raised issues with the cameras. In Norfolk, Virginia, the city is facing an ongoing lawsuit over the technology. Residents say the cameras amount to warrantless surveillance and a violation of the Fourth Amendment. But Sun Prairie Alder Mike Jacobs pushed back, pointing out that the police department can access other footage, like Ring cameras, if given consent.
You do not have a right to privacy on a public street. So there's no constitutional question about this. And if there were, we wouldn't be allowed to have Ring cameras, like I'm suggesting, right? Because we'd be invading people's privacy.
Alder Casey Drengler, a newcomer to the council, raised questions on the possibility of potential abuse. He brought up a recent case where a Kansas police chief used ALPRs to stalk his ex.
Where they were following, they were tracking their ex-partner's car, and not just that, but also their ex-partner's new partner's car.
Chief Hook says that there are multiple audit systems in place to prevent potential abuses, including that an officer must state a reason for tracking a vehicle. The proposal to approve ALPRs in this budget cycle failed with 4 ayes and 2 noes. It needed a 6 to pass as a budget amendment, but it could come up again in the next budget. For WORT News, I'm Dane Bulow.
And the time is now 6:24, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. The RCC Sexual Violence Resource Center is approaching its 52nd year of service here in Dane County. They'll be celebrating the anniversary this summer at their new location on Madison's east side. Meanwhile, the center is also grappling with funding uncertainty. Federal support for victim services has gone down significantly over the last couple of years, and state funding has only covered a fraction of those cuts. Dana Pelabon, the center's executive director, tells our producer, Faye Parks, that a funding request in the governor's budget proposal would keep the operations running smoothly over the next 2 years and prevent similar organizations across the state from shutting down entirely.
So RCC Sexual Violence Resource Center, we do a lot of different things. So in our direct service area, we work with survivors and their loved ones, those who may have recently experienced sexual violence or experienced sexual violence in the past. We do advocacy work, emotional support. We accompany people to medical appointments. We accompany people to forensic nurse exams. We do legal advocacy. We also are with people when they are just talking law enforcement, dealing with the court system. That's just the direct service side. We do also some case management work to really center the survivor's experience. We have a prevention and education team, and they are out in the community talking about our services, giving classes on consent, healthy relationships, bystander intervention. We have our Safer Bar program. We have our Chimera program. We have a 24-hour helpline that is available to anyone. And we also have a therapeutic program. We are CCS service providers. We have our Dane County Game Changers, which is our youth advocacy program. So we do a lot of things here in the community.
Now, after operating for more than 15 years on Madison's South Side, you're setting up shop at a new location next month. Tell us about the move. What are the benefits to this new location?
So we love being in the community that we are in. What we have found is that transportation has changed significantly since we have been in this particular building. And being on the BRT route is an important accessibility component to our move, making sure that people always have access to coming to appointments. Obviously, we meet people out in the community, but some people want to come to our office. And we do have programming that happens in our office. And with this space, we have the opportunity to do more in-office programming, so groups, having our Chimera classes in that space, having Safer Bar classes in that space, so that we can really service the community in a more outward fashion. So I want to let people know we will be having an open house at our new space in July 28th. That's going to be our 52nd anniversary. So we have been around in our Madison, Dane County area for 52 years, and we're excited to celebrate that 52nd year in a new space.
A familiar story lately, the center is also grappling with federal funding uncertainty under the new administration. Broadly speaking, a fraction of state money dispensed to victim services organizations every year trickles down from the feds. Emphasis on the word fraction. I understand that federal support has actually been shrinking for years now, and in turn, the state funding has also been shrinking too. Walk us through the numbers here. How much support has the center been getting each year?
So previous, when the state was receiving around $44 million from the VOCA grant in particular, we were receiving $500,000 a year from that VOCA grant for the last couple of award cycles. But last year, the max that we could apply for was $250,000. So we did get that $250,000 award, and that was a 50% cut. And from there, the state and Governor Evers, they found more money that they were able to give out in a smaller grant. The legislators did a fix, and we received an additional grant that did not still reach the level of what we lost, but we were very grateful for that fix and very grateful to our legislators and to our governor who recognized that such a dramatic cut could mean a very big change in services. So our governor has since put in $66 million in the budget to help fund these cuts for the next couple of years. My understanding is that there's bipartisan support, and we are very grateful that they're looking at restoring what it was that we had a couple of years ago, and understanding that that restoration is still at a level that wasn't sufficient, because there have been cuts that have been happening for a while now. And we are seeing that federal funds are changing. There were a couple of grants that we were going to apply for that we couldn't because the grants are no longer available. Those types of grants are sustaining the work that we provide free to survivors in our community. One of the other concerns is Medicaid. We have a CCS program that provides a different level of case management support and service facilitation for those who are dealing with AODA or substance abuse diagnoses. And that is vital support to people in our community. So we're all really nervous and yet have been grateful for the changes that are happening that we see in our legislators saying that they are taking this seriously and that they're hearing providers across the state who are looking at closure of programs.
Now, you mentioned that $66 million in the governor's budget proposal. As we know, budget writing is always a contentious time here in our state. How will your organization be affected if the state legislature nixes that expense from the final budget? What kind of changes would you have to make to remain operational?
Well, we would have to look at what we could have still funded. So, you know, we know we live in Dane County, and there are a lot of amazing nonprofits that do work. And there are a lot of my nonprofits that do a lot of great fundraising. And obviously, we can do more fundraising, but that is not a long-term sustainable plan. And so we may have to cut back on numbers of people. And the thing that is most concerning is for us at RCC, we've built a stable financial position for years. We've been working on plans like how to be sustainable outside of grants for a really long time. But what we cannot account for is smaller organizations across the state who will shut down, and those people will need services from other areas. And we're already seeing that with the shelter over at Days, where they are getting more people from out of county because shelters across our state are not able to sustain the levels they were before with the funding cuts already as they are. So you are looking at counties that will lose services altogether, and then those people will then come to counties that still have services. And so the increase of people who need help because we don't have the funds to be able to help them in the areas where they live is going to be a hardship. And we want to see all of our survivors across the state have access to services in their community. It's why this budget amendment is so important. We will help anyone that comes through our doors, and we are happy to do it. However, they deserve access to services in their area and to not have to travel for forensic nurse exams, not have to travel to receive court advocacy. Instead, they should be able to get it in their area. It's one of the reasons why we are talking very strenuously about this budget line item in particular.
I've been speaking with Dana Pelabon, Executive Director of the RCC Sexual Violence Resource Center in Madison.
You're listening to Handcrafted Local News here on WORT. Stay with us. We've got some more stories for you coming up in the second half of the show.
But first, we'll take a quick break. Stay tuned.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Five Nines, a locally owned cloud service provider of enterprise-level IT infrastructure consulting, hosting, and management services. On the web at fivenines.com. Phone number 512-1000.
Support for this program comes from the Konopka Lab at UW-Madison. Recruiting adults 55-plus for a clinical trial, testing whether a medication can promote healthy longevity. Details are at 608-228-2978.
And it's now 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Robert McClure, here with my co-host, Vicki Iden. Thanks for staying with us.
Up next is Cardinal Call, our weekly segment featuring the latest news from the UW-Madison campus. Hosts Oliver Gerhars and Ted Hingstrom teamed up this week to speak with the Daily Cardinals management team about their recent special issue, featuring stories about immigration in and around UW-Madison.
Hello and welcome to Cardinal Call, your biweekly dose of news from UW-Madison's own Daily Cardinal student newspaper. We are your hosts, Oliver Gerhars
and Ted Hingstrom. So each semester, the Daily Cardinal has an action project. This semester, our action project was called Uncertain Horizons, Immigration Wisconsin. And we've got the management team for the Daily Cardinal here to talk about it.
Hi, I'm Francesca Pica, and I'm the editor-in-chief of the Daily Cardinal.
Hi, my name is Ava. I'm the managing editor.
So I wanted to ask you guys why immigration was selected as the theme for this semester's action project.
There's a lot of rhetoric underneath our new administration about othering and kind of alienating immigrants in the country. And so we wanted to pick something that was very state specific that could still be applicable to what's going on in our country. So we looked at different industries that immigrants support in Wisconsin, whether it's educational or in the farming industry. We had people cover virtually any aspect of immigration. Obviously, a lot of the negative stuff going on with students and Fulbright, but also some more of the positive stuff, like how there's a lot of international students who come here to play sports, or how there's still like a 170-year-old German choir.
And on the university level, so much of UW-Madison runs on immigrants and international students and first-generation students. Just looking at, for example, we have entire departments in our language department and our language classes that rely entirely on international students and teaching assistants in order to even keep them open. They are the only people in this university who have the knowledge to teach those classes, and without them, students have fewer and fewer options to learn. Also looking at kind of actions of the administration on the state level, on the university level, you know, cuts to research funding, cuts to grant funding, cuts to program funding, that greatly affects kind of the ability of international students to come here to perform, you know, incredibly important research. Kind of on multiple levels, this issue is impactful to our university right now.
So I noticed you guys both mentioned the Fulbright article. Can you talk a little bit about the reporting on that, or at least what you know about it?
The reporting on this was very extensive, just because a lot of international students and TAs, very understandably, are not, you know, confident in going on the record and speaking about their experiences, because we have seen across the country this administration targeting international students who are on visas, revoking those visas or detaining them, you know, for speech and protest activity. So understandably, it's very difficult to get those students to talk on the record, but campus news editor Gavin Escott, he worked tirelessly to speak to as many people as possible in that Fulbright department and was able to get some people to talk about their experiences. And I think it really was an incredibly important article to just show how much of our university is reliant on the contributions of these international students.
You mentioned in there that some of the sources were off the record. I wanted to ask how, I noticed that more than usual because of the sensitive topic in this year's action project. What was it like navigating that?
I think that because it's such a sensitive topic, you have to approach it understanding that there really could be someone's like education on the line or even their livelihood on the line. I mean, this honestly goes for almost every article that was in this action project, because we had so many sources say like, no, I don't feel comfortable even having my name or even having a pseudonym, and they just wanted to be on background. So a lot of it was building trust with people and explaining, you know, this is coming from a standpoint of like, we want to give you a voice, like your story is very important, and it's, you know, it's integral to understanding what's happening right now in the country. And so like, we really appreciate that you're so willing to talk with us. So I would say trust building, and also letting them know that like, we are able to be more flexible with this topic. It's like one of the type of topics where like, I think journalists should really be able to kind of bend over backwards for people if needed.
Yeah, in our reporting in general, but especially surrounding these incredibly like difficult and high stakes issues, we always are balancing our desire to report kind of the most accurate and complete information we can. But we also understand that that's not always the case, and people have very understandable reasons for not wanting to put their name out in public right now. And so it's kind of just that balancing act and being able to kind of, you know, communicate with those sources what our expectations are, what we can kind of do to kind of protect their safety during this time and kind of meet them where they're at. And also kind of on our end, just making sure that we vet those sources and that they are who they say they are, so that even if we can't put their name in the print, our readers trust us that these are people who know what they're talking about.
So we've been focused on the hard news so far. Can you tell us a little bit more about the short shift desks like arts and sports and what they reported on for this action project?
So in terms of more of the short shift side, I mentioned this earlier, but we had arts cover a story on a 170-year-old choir. It originated from German immigrants, but it's open to like everyone now. Beyond arts, science looked at climate immigrants or climate refugees, and the writer for the article, interviewed someone named Jessica, and she came from Texas to Wisconsin, and she kind of wrote about how the Midwest is becoming more of a climate safe haven as things kind of heat up in the South. It was a really good article.
We also had a very interesting photo essay in this issue. Our photo editors, Cameron Schneider and Finnegan Rico, they did a really interesting thing where they kind of profiled three students and kind of their immigrant background with their families, kind of how they ended up coming to Madison and attending University of Wisconsin, and kind of how their experience kind of has shaped how they view campus life. And they did a really, really nice job kind of having both the photos to really show kind of these people's lives and their perspectives, while also writing little profiles of each of them and kind of having both words and photos work together on the photo page to really kind of make a really cohesive photo essay that I think really captures a lot of the kind of diverse student experience on this campus.
I have a question about the copy process. I don't know how much you had like going into this, but I noticed the colors, purple and then orange. Did that plan anything, or why did you choose to like copy it like that, I guess?
I kind of went into it really wanting purple. I really could not explain why, but I just feel like it's a very good color that comes out well in print. Our copy team, Clara and Zoe, helped pick the peach. And so we kind of gave them their own creative direction with it. I wish that I could say more into the deepness of the colors, but in terms of the actual cover as well, we did know we kind of wanted the Statue of Liberty on the front, just because I think it's pretty representative of the immigrant experience in the United States. It's a symbol, you know, Ellis Island and how immigrants were coming in at the time. So we felt like it was a good symbol of immigration. And then I think it turned out to be a very clean and simple cover, but very, you know, symbolic and strong. And I thought Isabel did a fantastic job.
Yeah, and kind of in action projects in general, when planning them out, you really plan for cohesion and you work closely with copy team and your graphics team and your photo team to really kind of make sure that you pick a color palette, you pick fonts, you pick kind of new interesting templates, and you stick to them so that, you know, like you can go absolutely ham and crazy on each page, but if they look completely different from each other, it's going to look terrible. So a lot of it was that work of really making sure we organize it and make it look cohesive. And with the purple and the peach, one thing we were kind of cognizant of when we were looking at potential different colors was that we didn't want to do something that was done recently. Like we recently did the democracy issue, which was blue, white, and red. Duh. But they're very bold colors. But we also didn't want something that looked garish. We called it school mascot colors, where if we had too many clashing colors or too bright colors, it kind of, I don't want to say it necessarily undercuts the seriousness of the topic, but, you know, you want something that kind of appropriately matches the type of topic that you're approaching with your action project. You don't want it to look completely disconnected or that it doesn't feel appropriate. Or we wanted things to look different, but we didn't want it to look not cohesive or disjointed.
That's all for the Cardinal Call this week. We've been your hosts, Oliver Gerhars
and Ted Hinkstrom. You can find more news and stories from UW-Madison's student journalists at dailycardinal.com.
And it's time now for the most comprehensive weather report on the airwaves with WORT weather expert Rob McClure.
Well, lovely day today with a good bit more sunshine than yesterday with its persistent cumulus and stratocumulus cloud cover. So that gave us an extra degree today. We got up to 55, even despite lighter winds and shallower vertical mixing. The lighter winds did make the temperature feel a good bit warmer than that single degree, however. April is edging back towards normal after a colder than normal start of more than 3 degrees, at least as of a few days ago. And that anomaly will continue to diminish over the coming days, not terribly quickly, however. We will have a storm approaching us from the west tomorrow and Friday, which will sharpen up our southerly winds. But the temperatures might not respond quite so aggressively to that southerly wind flow as once it had appeared, and for reasons I will go into shortly. Have a look at the water vapor satellite image of the contiguous U.S. that we have linked up at the top of the WORT weather webpage this evening, and you'll be able to see where we've come from over the past few days and hopefully a little bit of where we're going, therefore, both in the upper air and at the surface, since the surface isobars are analyzed on that water vapor image, so that'll show you the movement of the surface high and low pressure areas as well. At the beginning of the three-day sequence there, you can see this past Monday's storm spinning by us to the northwest, introducing the strong winds that characterized the past couple of days, visible there in the warren of yellow isobars that are slicing in towards Wisconsin from the northwest. Meanwhile, a big blob of surface high pressure slides southeastward across the central plains down to a position currently over Mississippi and Alabama. And that's now setting up the next concentration of isobars, running south to north this time from the western Gulf of Mexico up the plains just west of the Mississippi River. So far, that's sent a plume of low-level moisture up as far as eastern Oklahoma and Kansas, but that moisture will continue northward up the eastern plains during this overnight, lifting over drier and cooler air as it does so and producing a fair bit of high and mid-level cloud cover by the time we get into the day tomorrow. So that'll keep a lid on the temperature rise tomorrow, despite increasing southerly winds. Temperatures may be additionally suppressed as we get later in the day by some precipitation production aloft with evaporation below cloud base, which would produce additional evaporative cooling. Anyway, the lower levels will moisten up eventually. That'd be sometime either later in the day tomorrow or in the evening hours. Just that when that occurs and how much it occurs is a point of some contention on the forecast models. A good number of them now are holding off precipitation until the low-level jet strengthens in the evening and overnight hours tomorrow. We should see enough saturation and upward motion, though, by the time we get into the overnight period to set off showers and possibly even a thunderstorm or two, though the sounding profiles off the short-range forecast models aren't indicating a terribly much upward-directed energy developing, though what there is developing will be located probably about in the second mile above ground level, so these would be elevated thunderstorms if they do occur tomorrow night. And all of this weather will be the result of a surface low pressure center which will develop over the western plains, roughly in eastern Colorado tomorrow, ahead of an approaching upper trough, which if you have the water vapor image up in front of you, you can see at least a little bit towards the end of the sequence there, sharpening up over the northwestern U.S. The surface circulation will lift into western Wisconsin or perhaps directly up over us by about Friday morning, so that should swing the cold front past us and put an end to the precipitation in the earlier midday hours of Friday, hopefully with some cloud clearing then as we go later in the day and into the overnight and eventually through Saturday, and drier low-level air starts to deepen over the area. With southwesterly upper-level winds, however, over top of a southwest to northeast running surface front, the frontal motion may not be terribly fast, so passing high clouds, possibly along with some diurnal cumulus growth on the day Saturday, may again restrain the temperatures that day a bit. Northerly winds will veer east and southeast on Sunday as a second system approaches the area along that frontal boundary to our south, so that will also make for a kind of a coolish end to the weekend, with cloud cover re-thickening that day and possibly rains returning as well as we get on towards evening. But back to this evening for the specifics, the skies will see some increase in passing mid-level cloud cover going forward, but otherwise I think the waning egg moon will still light up the sky through much of the wee hours of tonight. Temperatures will drop towards the upper 30s on east to southeast winds at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, skies will see generally increasing high and mid-level clouds through the day, with perhaps some fall streaks developing later on, but with showers, I think, generally holding off until dark, at least down here at the surface. Lower clouds, I think, will thicken up later in the day. Temperatures will reach the mid to upper 50s and perhaps even 60 if the clouds do restrain themselves long enough. Southeasterly winds at 10 to 17 miles per hour may become a bit gusty in the afternoon and evening especially. Passing showers and thunderstorms then overnight may be somewhat scattered, but if we do get some thunderstorms going anyway, hail is a possibility given relatively low freeze levels this time of year. Temperatures will hold in the low to mid-50s overnight, with southerly winds bringing dew points to a more spring-like level by Friday morning. And Friday should see passing showers and possibly a thunderstorm still early on, but with the convection steadily waning from northwest to southeast across the area, I think through the morning and midday hours, temperatures will reach the mid-60s, possibly a little bit better than that, especially south and east, and especially if we get some clearing in the early day hours. Dew points will be up in the mid to upper 50s, so feeling a bit more damp. Veering southwest to west winds, though, through the day should start the temperatures and dew points both falling by the mid or late afternoon hours, eventually down to the low or mid 40s, at least with the temps, by Saturday morning. Northwesterly winds will be up at 8 to 12 miles per hour overnight. And Saturday should see a good bit of passing of high and mid-level cloud cover, as I mentioned, but I think enough sun to get the thermometer back to the low 50s anyway on lighter northerly winds. Clouds will start to increase again then from the west and southwest as we go overnight and System 2 approaches, holding temperatures around 40 or in the upper 30s. And Sunday will be mostly cloudy and perhaps with some cold rain working back into the areas, especially areas, say, from Madison south and east. Later in the day, high temperatures on Sunday will be in the mid-40s. At the moment, at the station down here on Bedford Street, the temperature is 54 degrees. The dew point temperature is 20. Winds are out of the south at 9 miles per hour, passing all the cumulus above the station at about 10,000 feet last I looked out. And the barometer's at 30.02 inches of mercury and holding steady over the past couple hours.
We go now to April 1967 for the closest mayor's race to date, a depressing report about Atwood Avenue, and a pop music breakthrough at the new County Coliseum. Stu Levitan has those headlines and more from 58 years ago this month on tonight's Madison in the 60s. All the years come by. They melt into a dream.
Madison in the 60s, April 1967. On the 1st, history graduate student Paul Soglin quits the WSA Student Senate to focus on campus community relations through the new University Community Action Party. On the 2nd, legendary bebop trumpeter Dizzy Gillespie brings his quintet to the Union Theater for two shows. On the 3rd, the faculty approve a new visitation plan, allowing each residence hall living unit to decide by a two-thirds vote whether to allow visitors of the opposite sex in their rooms. They'd be eligible to do that between noon and 10 p.m. on either Saturday or Sunday. Visitations are voided if the living unit serves beer at a social function before or during the visitation period. House officers will be responsible for enforcing the requirement that doors, quote, must be left ajar during visits. April 4th is Election Day, and Mayor Otto Feske is in the fight of his life. Feske, the longtime Dane County clerk, won his first term in 1965 by 8,000 votes. But crime and taxes are both up, college students are causing trouble, the building trades are on strike, and everything feels like it's breaking down. So tonight, he's ahead by only 30 votes, with just one precinct left to report. The 46-year-old Feske almost got to run unopposed, but attorney and former broadcast personality William Dyke entered the race just hours before the January 31st deadline. The 35-year-old, who finished third in the seven-way primary 2 years earlier, campaigns almost exclusively on Feske's spending, taxes, and purported failures of leadership, and avoids culture and crime. A former aide to GOP Lieutenant Governor Jack Olson, Dyke enjoys active support of local and state Republican officials, while the Dane County Democratic Party doesn't even endorse Feske, even though he had been elected county clerk 6 times as a Democrat. At least the Madison Federation of Labor's Committee on Political Education does endorse the incumbent. Feske cites as his primary accomplishment the recent acquisition of a site on Milwaukee Street for the long-sought East Side Hospital, making progress on the Monona Basin Auditorium and Civic Center, and forming the Alliance of Cities to lobby for better state shared revenue. And he notes that most of the tax hike has been for the schools, not city services. Feske runs moderately well throughout the city. Dyke wins fewer wards, but by larger margins, especially his Nakoma neighborhood. It all comes down to University Heights, a precinct with 1,000 votes. About 10 p.m., the last numbers come in. Feske 511, Dyke 474. Fesky gets his second term by just 75 votes, reduced to 62 after a recount, 17,261 to 17,199. He's in for another term, which will be even rougher than the first. No such struggles on this election day for Ruth Bacaber Doyle, easily re-elected to her second three-year term on the school board. Doyle, the first woman elected to the state assembly from Dane County in 1948, and later a Dane County supervisor, is the project assistant for the UW program focusing on recruitment and support of black students. Her husband is federal judge James E. Doyle Sr. Fesky's planning department continues its work on the Atwood Avenue Business District, issuing a bleak report in April on its, quote, depressing, unexciting appearance that is unplanned, inconvenient, unattractive. A commercial district of old, deteriorating structures and skyrocketing vacancies. City consultants Midwest Planning and Research Incorporated find most of the buildings are in poor or fair condition and a, quote, declining community spirit, especially among the young people living and working in the area, evidenced by a lack of local focus on neighborhood problems. Their 72-page solution is a private urban renewal plan, starting with a 40,000-square-foot shopping center featuring a full-service supermarket and chain drugstore on the lakeside corner of Atwood Avenue and Winnebago Street. In order to provide a more pedestrian-friendly environment by diverting cars from Shanks Corners, the consultants propose a new road aligned with the railroad tracks from First Street to Division Street. The report also says the venerable Eastside Businessmen's Association has become, quote, too diffused to be effective in promoting the area's revitalization, and recommends a new nonprofit corporation be created to acquire and redevelop properties. On the 8th, the Student Peace Center presents the largest anti-military ball yet, featuring satirical skits and music by Ben Sidran and Johnny Cal. On the 11th and 12th, a coalition led by Students for a Democratic Society, United Community Action, and the Committee to End the War in Vietnam conducts an orderly rally and picketing of CIA recruitment interviews at the law school. About 150 students, mostly young women, sit in without obstructing, while up to 800 rally on Bascom Hill. About 50 students interview with the agency, although some, like former SDS leader Marty Tandler, who lists another SDS officer as a reference, are not actually seeking employment. On the 12th, pop music makes its first appearance at the Dane County Coliseum, with Paul Revere and the Raiders performing as the headliners. On the 20th, School Superintendent Robert Gilberts, who succeeded Philip Falk in January 1963, accepts appointment as the superintendent of the Denver Public School System. On July 5th, the school board votes 4-3 to name West High School Principal Douglas Ritchie superintendent. Doyle, who cast the only vote against Ritchie's appointment as principal in 1964, leads the opposition, saying Madison is too big to be a starter district for a first-time superintendent. And April is indeed the cruelest month, as two Madison families mourn soldier sons killed in Vietnam. On the 14th, Army Private First Class James Cliffcorn, 22, Edgewood Academy Class of 1962, is fatally shot while serving with the 1st Cavalry Division in the Ann Low Valley. Cliffcorn was 3 months shy of graduating from Mary Knoll Seminary and entering the priesthood when he dropped out to join the Army and go to Vietnam. Army Specialist 4th Class Leonard D. Thompson, 21, 42 Worth Court, is killed when his tank battalion is ambushed in Quang Tri Province on April 25th. A member of Plymouth Congregational Church, he worked at Sub-Zero before entering the Army shortly after his graduation from East High School in 1965. He had been in country for about 6 months. And that's this week's Madison in the 60s. For your award-winning, listener-supported WORT News Team, I'm Stu Levitan.
And that does it for our show this evening. Thanks for listening to WORT's Live Local News at 6. Our writers this evening were Greg Sanderson and Jack Goodman. Dane Bula was your reporter. Special thanks to our feature contributors, Oliver Gerhards, Tud Hinkstrom, and Stu Levitan. Katie Gergella is our on-air engineer. Faye Parks produced the newscast, and Shelley Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Robert McClure.
And I'm your host, Vicki Iden. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is Query, followed by This Way Out. Good night.
Listening to WORT Madison.
Attention, WORT volunteers and donors. WORT is holding an election for 2 open participating member seats and 1 open listener sponsor seat to serve 3-year terms on the board of directors of Back Porch Radio Broadcasting, Inc., with terms beginning at the annual meeting in June and concluding at the annual meeting in June 2028. Financial acumen, computer literacy, and a willingness to work within a dynamic group to help shape this great station are all desirable qualifications. People of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply. Some committee hours are required outside of board meetings. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. on Thursday, May 15th to ensure consideration. Voting begins Thursday, May 29th and continues until the annual meeting on Sunday, June 29th.